This is Gary Lactus reporting for Mindless Ones. It's about 9:15 in the morning on the morning of the Saturday Kapow. I've just got on a train. It's been quite an eventful morning already. I got on the bus from my flat, and first I said, "Can I have a centre fare, please?" And I put my tenner down, and he said, "Just take a seat." I didn't even have to pay, so that was good. And then coming into the station, there was a man. He stopped me. I'm wearing jeans, a jumper, and I have a rucksack in which I'm carrying a laptop and various other bits and bobs. And he said, "What are you going to do when the weather changes?" And I said, "I'll probably wear a coat." And he said, "It's not going to stay like that. You don't get this sort of weather for 3 months. It is quite a nice day." I didn't quite know what to say. And then he said, "Money's changed as well." So, yes, that was a lovely little interaction there. I'm just sort of setting the scene for you, because, you know, I'm going up to Kapow, and I hope to bring you all of my adventures. I'm quite tired. I've probably had just enough sleep for the journey ahead of me, my quest. I said goodbye to Lady Lactus this morning. She was half asleep. That was good. So I could just sort of sneak out. But, yeah. I hope you'll join me on my odyssey. This is Gary Lactus, signing off for now. I'm going to fill in some gaps here, because, to be honest, I felt like a bit of a prick talking into my recording device on my own in front of lots of people, so this is recorded afterwards. I got there. There was a very big queue. I was informed that Kapow had sold out, which was great news, great success. Unfortunately, it meant Yawn, our mindless associate, who I was going to meet, couldn't get a last-minute ticket. So I was there on my own. I queued up for quite a long time, but it was a fairly fast-moving queue. There were a good few hundred people snaking round the block, waiting to get in. Mostly men. Saw lots of superhero T-shirts and the like. Got in and had a quick look around. Saw a couple of people I sort of knew from Cartoon County. David Lloyd was there, and Ace Inca Bambos was there as well. I sort of wandered upstairs a little way, and I saw a queue, and I thought, I'll get in a queue. There's probably something happening. And it turned out to be the 2000 AD panel, which was one of the best things I saw all weekend, actually. And I have recorded it, so you're now going to hear the 2000 AD panel recorded from the microphone is positioned third row back on the left between my legs, so you have a sort of penis ears view of this event. Sat down from left to right, I believe, were the wonderful Brendan McCarthy, and then Steve Yowell, and then Chris Weston, followed by Jock, followed by writer Al Ewing, and then the current Tharg. I could tell you his name, but I prefer not to spoil the mystery there. So Tharg, let's call him Tharg. He wasn't dressed up as Tharg, he was just a man, but he's Tharg. And coming in a little bit later, sat next to Tharg, was Dave Gibbons. So I hope you enjoy this recording. All apologies for the for any sound quality issues, but hopefully you'll find something in there of merit.
Hello, hello and welcome to the 2008 panel. I should start off by introducing all the guests. Do you want to do it individually?
I'm Al Ewing. I write Zombo, Damnation Station, and Judge Dredd occasionally.
Hello.
You hear that?
Yeah.
I'm Brian Bolland and Dave Gibbons. I'm Jock, and I drew Judge Dredd a while ago, and I've been working on the new Judge Dredd film as well.
Is this on? Can you hear me? I'm Chris Weston, mainly known for Killing Time, the Indigo Prime story, Cannon Fodder, and more recently a couple of Future Shocks.
I'm Steve Yowell. I'm currently drawing Red Seas for Tish Out.
Quay Quan Blag, everybody. I'm Brendan McCarthy, and older ones will remember me from bygone eras.
We'll start on that tap, I think, and Brendan, you're probably the artist that's been working on 2008 since the early days. I mean, how did you get started on it, and how did you find out about 2008 when it first started?
The first wave of artists was the Brian Bolland, Dave Gibbons generation, which were obviously fantastic, great giants of our industry, and literally, if you've seen Dave Gibbons, he's very tall. And I saw 2008 in the newsagent one day and just thought, what's that? That looks a bit different. It was I actually saw the second one, and it had a Dredd story in it, and it was Dredd that immediately sprang out to be something a bit different. And you got to remember, this is going back to like 25 years or something, and there was nothing around then. And it just was one of those things. It became a sort of lightning rod for all sorts of talent, and I pitched to, nervously sent stuff at the 2008 editorial, and they actually said, yes, do you want to do a cover, which was bizarre. And, so I was working with a guy called Brett Newman, and the two of us actually literally drew a cover together, him drawing one end of the page and me the other, and we sent it in, and they even strangely printed it. And if you've ever seen those early covers we did, they're really awful. But nonetheless, it's just, if you look at my early work, it's really terrible. It's a great inspiration for people who are also really terrible and actually get really good if you keep doing it and keep harassing the hell out of people like that.
My introduction to 2008 on Nagy was pretty much the same as Brendan's. The way it stood out for me was that it was an exclusively science fiction comic. I think the weekly British comic industry was still quite thriving in the mid-70s, wasn't it? I mean, there was plenty of football titles, adventure titles, DC Thompson was still throwing out things like Victor and... whatever. I got started in the industry through in those days in the early 80s. There was still this strata of comics you could move through to becoming a full professional. You'd start in the fanzines working for nothing, and then from those you'd graduate up to things like Harrier Comics, where you got paid peanuts, and eventually you might get a break on at Marvel UK or on Too Foul drawing a Future Shock. And I got to know Grant Morrison through both working on little small press stuff and through the SSI and through David Lloyd trying to put a project together called Fantastic Adventure. One thing led to another. I started to work for Marvel UK, got a break at Too Foul, and that led to Zenith after Brendan and Grant had been designing it for several months leading up to it. And the rest isn't history.
I think the first prog I ever saw was number 3, the one with the blood being by the dinosaur on the front cover going, oh, shoot me, don't let it eat me alive, boss. And I thought, yes, this is the comic for me. Didn't really see that sort of gore in DC Thompson titles. And I was hooked after that. It was like a drug. I mean, my 2008 fix, and every week. And I even used to wake up at 6, in the morning on a Friday, and run down and wait by the door for the paperboy to deliver it. You know, it's very exciting. And I suppose I got into 2000, you know, it's after all the giants like Dave Gibbons and Ken Kennedy and Brian Bolland, after they all buggered off to America in the late 80s, there was a real void waiting to be filled by new artists, and I sort of got sucked into that void.
Were you still reading 2000 when you were living on Cyprus, or did you have to?
Yeah.
So how did you get hold of it, you know, through...
They had news agents on the army bases.
They had what?
but we got them about 6 weeks late, though, unfortunately. It was when we finally moved from Cyprus back to England. You know, I missed a gap of six progs.
So were you 6 weeks behind with the dinosaur cover? Sorry, 6 weeks after.
Oh, I was actually in England. I was staying with my nan when I saw the dinosaur cover.
I was kind of late. I was like 13 or 14 when I started reading 2000 AD. I think it was around just after 500. But it's the old story. It kind of blew the back of my head off, really, and I decided straight away that I wanted to draw comics. And then went on a sort of slightly sad teenage collecting binge of trying to collect every issue and read every Dread story there was, which I did. And then I met Steve McManus at a Glasgow convention in 1995, me and Don Reardon. We were kind of young, we didn't have any money, we were signing on, and we hitched from Devon up to Glasgow. And Steve McManus, we showed our work to Glenn Fabry first, who said, F off and make some money. Why are you showing me? And apparently Steve McManus heard about this and kind of came looking for us, which was kind of, you know, quite a cool weekend. But then we didn't really keep up contact, and it wasn't until about year 2000 I met Andy Diggle, who was the assistant editor, and he liked what I did. And David Bishop didn't, but Andy took over editorialship of Judge Dredd magazine and offered me a Dredd story as my first job, which was great. And then Dave phoned halfway through me doing it to offer me a Dredd story for 2000 AD, and Andy was a bit like, you know, I told you so. But
and you've been married ever since.
Yeah, basically, yeah, I can't get rid of Diggle ever since then. Really, we've worked together many times. Hey, here's Dave Gibbons.
Hi, guys.
Hey.
I'm sure we could be road walking when everybody started, but
get another seat, maybe.
Yeah, brilliant.
So it's good, isn't it? 2008.
Yeah, I'm relatively recent. 2002, I think I started, and that was started reading age of 9. That wasn't in 2002; that was earlier. it was. I was a story of hope actually, because I came in through the submissions. It does work. I came in. I think I sent in a Territel, was it, or a T-shirt? One of those. It was a Territel, and that first one, not immediately, but eventually that first one ended up after a rewrite or two getting printed, which obviously gave me a big kind of boost, which, and then the standard process of getting rejected a lot and getting published occasion, you know, gradually you sort of get better and kind of claw your way up the ranks. So, yeah, that's what happened to me.
Dave, we're talking about how we got into 2000 AD. How did you make your break into it?
All right, well, the first I remember of 2000 AD was, and I can see it as clearly as if it was yesterday. Come back with me to those days of 1976. God, it was a long time ago. I used to live in the same town as Mick McMahon, and we sort of knew each other a bit because one of the local papers had done a feature on me. And he'd seen it and sent me an uncharacteristically respectful letter. Dear Mr. Gibbons, I was so thrilled to read that a professional comic book artist lived so close to me. I am an aspiring artist. You know, I would like to meet. So we did. And then one morning I bumped into him on the station. I was going up to London and he had some artwork under his arm. And I said, oh, what's that? He said, oh, it's this thing I'm doing for this new comic. So I said, oh, what is it? He said, oh, it's called Judge Dredd. And it was the pencils of the first Judge Dredd thing. And I said, what new comics is this? I haven't heard anything of this. And I was going into London to see my agent. I worked for an agent then. And he said, oh, yeah, it's... Because at the time it was probably called JNP 15, you know, Junior New Publication 15, they didn't have names, they just had numbers. He said, oh, I'll see if I can get you on it. And then one thing led to another. He took me over to King's Reach Tower. I shook hands with Pat Mills, and they got me to do a sample of Harlem Heroes, which they seemed to like out of all the ones they've had, and that was it. I was off.
Why do you think 2000D has survived as long as it has? I mean, with all these comics that were around at the time, it just seems to be the one that has managed to endure. Do you think there's something special about it?
Well, I think there is something special about 2000 AD, and I think probably what's special about 2000 AD is Pat Mills and John Wagner. I think I would have to say the incredible, you know, burst of enthusiasm that the whole thing started off with, and the energy and the desire to do something new and with a very clear vision. Because up until that time, all the other JNPs, 1 to 14, had been like pallid imitations of, you know, the lion or the tiger or something like this. Then came Battle, which was a whole departure, and then came Action, which again was the beginning of it, and it culminated in 2000 AD, which was, I don't know, it's all those things that you always loved all rolled together, you know, like sort of Mars Attacks bubblegum cards and horror comics and science fiction and political commentary and sarcasm and humour. It just seemed to have everything going for it. But I think it has become an institution. I think the audience has grown up with 2000 AD. And, you know, I think even as the editor, you probably would agree with me, is that it has its highs and lows, but there's always something redeeming. There's always some series, even if a lot of your favourites aren't in it, there's always one thread that you're following. And I think that's why it's got its longevity. And I get it every week. Thank you very much, Matt. And I still enjoy it to this day. And it still has got that kind of slightly punky, you know, feel to it, which I like.
How, as a sort of relative newcomer, I mean, was writing in 2000 always what you wanted to do?
Yeah, pretty much. It feels kind of horribly nerdy to say, but yeah, it pretty much is a kind of dream come true, especially the Judge Dredd part, because that's always been and still is my favourite comic character, and that's because you can do anything with him, which you can't really do with... you can do anything with a few comic characters, you know, Batman... No, you can't tell a comedy story with Batman. You can, but you can't make him a figure of fun, really. Whereas with Dredd, I think you probably could. I'm digging myself a hole there. I love it. It's great. It is what I've always wanted to do. It is a dream come true. That's pretty much, that's the answer to that question.
I think Al's doing an amazing job of writing Judge Dredd, say, by the way. As a Dredd, huge fan, yeah, I think you're...
Always nice to hear.
Is there anything else about 2000E that appeals to the rest of the panel? Is there something that makes it stand out from the rest of the comics out there? And why is it a British comic that's still going?
Probably just the talent. I mean, the people sat around me here, you know, is sort of testament really, sort of for years gone by and current as well. That's certainly what I liked about it when I was young, and still now I get inspired by it. And that's at the end of the day, any good film, any good, you know, book, any good comic, that's what it should do. And 2000 AD does.
Yeah, it allows you to experiment in ways that you can't in the big American two, you know, won't allow you. I mean, when I started on Cannon Fodder, I just thought, I know, I'm going to do each panel on a different coloured paper and paste them onto my board and do it with markers and splash acrylic on it. And I really can't see that happening across the pond. You know.
Try vertigo, you'll be fine.
Yeah. Try vertigo.
Yeah, I'm second to what Chris says, really. It's always been a case of less money than you'd earn from the Americans, but more freedom, I think.
For me, the thing that keeps me interested in 2000 AD is that I like to spot who's coming up and who are the new people, and it's broken so many people. You know, you think of pretty much every name, big name. I mean, one of my first gigs was... a script that baffled me called the Flondurian Phrasebook by a bloke called Alan Moore, you know. people like Grant Morrison rolled up in it, Jamie Hewlett, but then, you know, and all the names that go on to become megastars often cut their teeth in 2000 AD. So I always give it a look. And as Dave says, sometimes it goes through periods where I'm not very interested in it. Other times, you think, hang on a minute, there's something, there's a buzz about 2000 AD again. At the moment, I think it's actually going through a good, I think it's in a very good period, 2000 AD, and that's why I've been quite excited to start working for it again, you know, and just done a Judge Dredd, the Walking Dredd, I think.
I'll turn to you, Dave. I'd say that one of the most strong things about 2000 AD is the characters and how iconic a lot of them look, and that leads to how popular, and you created one of the most iconic in Rogue Trooper. How do you go about creating a character from scratch like that?
Well, Rogue Trooper was initially a result of a reader poll. It was, you know, what sort of stories would you like to see in 2008, which is generally a pretty bad idea. Because, you know, they inevitably want, well, they got Rogue Trooper, you know, death and science fiction, you know, that's I mean, you could maybe even sum 2008 up in those terms. So, you know, me and Jerry Finley Day were assigned to do it, and it was good because I had the opportunity to do loads of sketches, loads of ideas. I came up with loads of ideas that didn't ever make it in there, which was a bit disappointing to me. And many years later, when I got the chance to write it, I wrote it the way I wanted to write it. And I said, for a start, they're not having the biochips are a stupid idea. And the overwhelming fan reaction was, where are the biochips?
Give us back out. I brought the biochips back.
Yeah. So that shows you how much I know. But it's weird. When I look back at characters I've created, quite a lot of them are blue. I don't know why. There's a poacher, there's Dr. Manhattan, you know, I think really I'm just recycling the same old blue crap over there.
And Brendan, you created some of the ABC Warriors. You're responsible for Steelhorn, I believe. So I think that's one of the funny ones. I mean, was it, were you given pretty much a free rein to with them? Or
no, I didn't really do very much ABC Warriors. That was, I think, was that created by Pat Mills, wasn't it? And Mike McMahon was in his, you know, was absolutely knocking him out of the park every week when his stuff was out. So I was just a pale shadow of Mike McMahon in those days. I hadn't really found my own voice. And I don't really, I mean, I think maybe I did. I can't remember, I'll be honest with you. I had a bit more involvement in creating ancillary Judge Dredd characters and a strip called Sooner or Later, which also Jenny Hewlett did the sequel to, called Hewligan's Haircut. I can't remember.
But I mean, Steve, you worked on Zenith, obviously, but you were working from Brendan's Designs, I believe, is that right? I mean, did two of you collaborate, or did you...
No, I, as I remember it, I pretty much just inherited the designs you'd done for Zenith, didn't I? Which I don't know to what extent, how much backwards and forwards there'd been between yourself and Grant to come up with that... That drape coat and big boot Morrison haircut design. Yeah.
Inspired by yours.
What I got was I got Brendan's designs for Zenith, White Heat, Dr. B, Maximan, you'd done.
Dr. Cloud Nine, was it such a person?
Mandela, you'd done.
Oh, right.
And Cloud Nine was the super team, wasn't it? And Grant had designed Ruby and Lux, Red Dragon. I can't remember if I missed any out. So I pretty much took those and ran with them. I got the opportunity to restyle Zenith ever so slightly for the subsequent series. The idea always was that as he was a pop star, he was going to be constantly updating his image anyway. And then I got to design or restyle most of the characters for Series 3, which was the big epic across the alternate Earths.
Chris, I mean, you've got some characters in here, like Cannon Fodder, you mentioned before, Indigo Prime as well. And, I mean, again, were you pretty much given free reign to design those, or were you led a lot by, like, John Smith on Kevin Tyne?
All I got, basically, were their names, Winwood and Cord. And... I don't think there was any more description than that, really. I think I asked John, saying, well, what'd it look like? And he said, just said, one's in a zoot suit, one looks posh, and I think that was about it, really. And I didn't end up using the zoot suit either. But I'll be interested to see what Edmund Bagwell's doing with them, you know. I'm sort of half excited about it and, you know, half frightened about it because I'm fully aware that my time as the world's favourite Indigo Prime artist is, you know, about to be over.
Yes, Indigo Prime is coming back this summer, hopefully. I might have some artwork if the thing works. Is there any artwork coming up?
No.
Okay, well, there's some great artwork up there. Jock, you've done a few Dread stories, but I don't think you actually haven't co-created a series for 2008. Apart from Lenny Zero, of course.
Yeah.
I mean, that was pretty much a very close collaboration with Andy, I would have thought, was it?
What, Lenny?
Yeah,
I did Andy Diggle's first strip. Writing job was Lenny Zero, which he did for free to save the budget. He was editor at the time, and he sort of was getting a bit fed up with editing and wanted to write. And he decided to save the budget that it would cost paying a writer to do a 10-page story to be able to afford Frank Miller for the cover of the 10th anniversary Judge Dredd magazine. Which worked out. He wrote it for free, and people seemed to like it. Frank did the cover, and David Bishop phoned him up. And Frank said, "Don't ever call me again, or you use the cover." So that's another story. But anyway, so Lenny Zero was based in Mega City One. So there wasn't a whole lot of creating to do, but at the same time, I think me and Andy both wanted to bring something to it, and it sort of planted the seeds of what sort of certainly artwork-wise, what I wanted to do with what we went on to do with the Losers, and a more kind of designy sense, you know, and a sort of more snappy kind of story, perhaps. And Andy writes great scripts, you know, there's a lot of twists and turns, and the readers seem to like it, and that was what gave him the impetus to stop being Tharg, assistant Tharg, and. Mini Tharg and take up writing, which I'd say he made the right choice, really.
Al, from the writer's point of view, I mean, when it comes to creating a new series, have you created like Damnation Station and Dead Signal, Zombo? I mean, well, that was all that aside from Henry's point of view. But I mean, when it comes to creating a new series, what do you write what you'd love to read in the prog or Are you thinking of the characters from the start?
That's pretty much what I like to read in the prog and what I'd like to write. With Damnation Station, I was very interested in kind of taking a lot of risks and doing a lot of experimentation. And you know, I think a lot of people really enjoyed that. A lot of people liked the no translations, no captions. Kind of you weren't seeing what was in everybody's heads. You had to kind of. And with the alien speak, I was doing that slightly wanky Alan Murray thing of coming up with my own language, and you know, it's a very, very simple one. It's you could probably, it's like one of those codes you could sit down and break it pretty easily if you wanted to. But it also kind of helped give it that air of mystery. So there was that. And with Zombo, That was fantastic. I was lying earlier when I said Judge Dredd was my favourite comic character. I was trying to appear humble. but no, Zombo has just been a fantastic experience from start to finish. And it's not finished yet. Not nearly. Series 3 coming up pretty soon. What program was that?
1740.
Brilliant. 1740. That's coming up. And that's gonna be a lot of fun. But that pretty much leapt out of one line in Henry's original pitch, which was the a bit of dialogue that he gave Zombo in the pitch, which was "How do you like your meal, Mr. Fishy?" Which was, and from that, pretty much the whole personality of Zombo is kind of encoded in that one line. That's pretty much. I mean, when I'm writing Zombo, I'm just writing what I'd like to read, which is a kind of, you know, gory comedy. Comedy series, and I think when it gets to series 4, we're going to take it back to the kind of creepy roots, the kind of creepy origins, because it was a lot creepier in series 1 than it's become. It's become a lot more straight out comedy, and I think we're both thinking, yeah, let's swing it back a bit now. But series 3, you will laugh, and if you don't, I will hurt you. You will laugh if you know what's good for you. You will.
Can I ask panel their favourite 2000 E stories, if they have a particular favourite?
Well, I mean, I suppose I'm a bit old school, but, you know, I do look back to the days when Brian Bolland and Rick McMahon were doing Dread. I think that was some, you know, that was just the right place, the right time, the right stories, the right artists. That, I think, you know, is part of the major history of comics. But I think the thing I really like about 2000 AD, and Chris touched on this, he was talking about cutting out different colour bits of paper to do each panel on. It's always a real, I was going to be flashing and say it's smorgasbord, but that kind of, it's a real kind of assortment of different styles, different approaches. I don't know, and when you say that this new story of ours is going to be in Prog 1740, you know, this is like this vast landscape of interest and events and high spots and low spots. It's very hard to isolate one. I suppose I mention those two particular artists because they were friends of mine. And in the early days of 2018, I don't know if it's so nowadays, there was a real kind of esprit de corps and a kind of friendly rivalry as well, that everybody wanted to do their best work and not let anybody down. So, I mean, I saw the creation of a lot of those from the inside. I even filled in the blanks on some of Mixed Pages, which is, I think you have to admit, I did very well. It was probably one of the major reasons for their success. Yeah, I'll always hold that particular era and those stories rather dear.
You stopped doing solid blanks not long after that. Started doing sketchy sort of woodcut look.
He's never been the same since I left.
Al, if you had to take one story, 2000 story, to a desert island, what would it be?
Oh, that's a tough one. It'd probably be The Graveyard Shift, that Graveyard Shred story with Joyner and Ron Smith. Because, I mean, that was the first kind of... the first time Dread went into that that slightly Hill Street bluesy direction that we're kind of very used to now. And everybody loves. I love it. Everyone else should. I'm just saying. But that was absolutely, at the time, that just blew me away. I remember picking up in the back issues, and that was just astonishing, just the number of different stories that were kind of coming together. And it's only about five or so parts, but it feels like...
It's 10, isn't it? I think it's 10.
Really?
I think so, or 8 or 9.
I remember rereading it recently and thinking it's a lot shorter.
No, there's a... sorry to correct you, but...
Okay, in that case, it's 10 parts, but it reads like 20. that would be mine. The Graveyard Shift.
Yeah, that is a great story. Mine's probably actually Midnight Surfer, actually a Judge Dredd story, because Cam Kennedy's artwork is... the city is a living, breathing, organic, but completely real place. Draws great vehicles. I like that Dredd's the bad guy in it. You know, I love that with Dredd, he can be the hero, the anti-hero. He can represent, you know, the fascist state. He can be anything really. And I think Midnight Surfer, it was really about Chopper, and it was an interesting take on it. But really, really became something else with Cam's amazing visuals, I think.
Well, I'm not just saying it because he's on the panel, but the story that really... It was probably the first comic story that moved me was the Robusters run with Charlie the Robot saving Northpool from the bulldozers. I think that was the first comic that brought a lump to my throat, the ending where he rises from the water and all the crowds are singing. And God, if I'm beginning to make inroads in Hollywood, and if I get any power there whatsoever, I'm going to say, make a film of this, it's fantastic, it's got giant robots, it's got warships, and it's going to move you in ways that a Transformers film never could.
I don't have much more to add to what everyone's already said, but I'm just going to big it up for Ron Smith's Dread, because I always felt you managed to portray the megacity as being this vast, sprawling metropolis of multi-layered flyovers and tiny vehicles whizzing around in the distance.
Actually, it's quite interesting, because I agree Ron's city's amazing, but he doesn't put in a lot of detail at all. It's all suggested. It's all kind of, I think he drew quite quickly. And when you actually look at it, there's not a great deal there, but the impression you get from it
Well, does everyone know the story of the alarm clock?
Yeah.
Does anyone else in the audience? No. The story is that Ron Smith used to sit with a clock by his drawing table, and he'd assign a time to each page, and he'd start putting all the basics of the page, but all the major elements are needed, and then if there's time over, he'd start adding background details. And as soon as the clock went off, he'd ting. Put the page to one side, start the next page, start the clock again. And then apparently he would finish off bits and pieces in his spare time. But he was a very, very organised professional artist.
Like Dave, I'm very fond of the classic Dread Run, where there was a sort of artistic balance between Brian Bolland and Mike McMahon. Particularly the Bolland stuff like the Jack the Ripper one and was it the Forever Crimes and all that sort of stuff. And then the Mick McMahon was completely... I mean, I tended to be in the Mick McMahon sort of wing of artists, and, just his stuff was phenomenal. His Slane, I think, is beautiful. I mean, there's just so much stuff, really. Bad Company by my friend Brett was a really nice strip in, the first three seasons of that. Pete's writing was great. There's a lot of, there's just so much good stuff in 2000 AD, but, it's... It's great that it's still there and there's some good stuff. Oh, wow.
Brendan, you'd like to discuss this picture?
This is a story I pitched to Matt. I just said, what happens if Dredd gets bitten by a zombie? What would happen? Would he just become a zombie? Is there anything else going on? So from that, Matt bounced it with another writer and we kind of cooked up this thing. So this is basically The Walking Dread, I'm calling it, or Dawn of the Dread, as Al christened it. So that's a cover for the magazine coming up. Is it May issue, isn't it, Matt?
Yes, magazine 311.
Yeah, so I mean, it's really obvious to do The Walking Dread, but I mean, nobody done it. Oh, come on, that's pretty obvious. So it was fun to do that, actually. I haven't done comics for about 20 years, a long time, and I've just been starting to get my mojo back, trying to work out how to do, how to do comics in the digital age now. It's a different kind of world, really, and so I'm just trying to get some style happening, what I'm interested in doing is keeping the organic brushiness of paperwork, but also get a bit more of the digital kind of stuff happening in the art. I kind of see, I'm seeing the influence of digital similar to like electronic and music. We think of the Eurythmics and how they let electronica actually be the sound. I'm quite interested in allowing the digital, what the actual computer does digitally, to be on the page as well. So a lot of it I don't do, the computer does it, and I go, okay, I'll leave that as is. Because I find that, to me, it gives it a different look. So, I'm surprised to see that one up there. Thanks, man.
There's another page of it somewhere on the... Oh, here we go. That's the first page from the...
So what I'm doing, if you see, also artistically, I'm all that was done in black and white wash, and then I've selected the stuff out and saturated the colours, and then dropped in all these massively oversaturated backgrounds where the... So basically, all I'm doing is letting the Photoshop program to produce the visuals in the same way as, an electronic music artist would allow the synthetic electronic sound to and let it be. So, it's and also in the backgrounds that I'm giving it, I've been sort of talking to some graffiti artists a lot recently who are doing kind of comics on the street. They're doing graffiti stuff on the street in spray and stuff. So, I've been trying to get a bit of that graffiti spray vibe into the pages. So, that's where this is where I'm at the moment, just finding my way back into drawing comics again.
Nice flanging going on.
This,
here we go.
This is obviously Simon Fraser. Yeah. This is a splash page from an upcoming 12-page Dante story called The Memoirs of Nicolai Dante. This will be coming up in about 2 weeks' time. And I'll sort of kick off the next batch of Dante stories. Robbie felt it was a good idea to tell a recap to any readers that might be a bit lost on Dante continuity and who's what and who's when and who's dead and who's not. This is kind of a very, very succinct 12-page recap of the entire Dante history over the past 10-15 years of what's been running. We're building up to the end of the Dante saga. There'll be about another
three series to go after this, and then it's over. I'll just run through some stories that are coming up in 2000E in the near future. This is a page of Carlos's artwork from a Cadet Anderson story that Alan Grant has written. Six-part story, which sees Anderson going undercover to bring a teenage gang of perps to justice. Slightly older Anderson from the one that ran in the Christmas prog, so she's about 16, 17 here. I thought it was quite interesting that we've never seen Anderson as a cadet, because we know her history that she was inducted into the Academy of Law when she was about 5 years old, having murdered her father, and the memory was blocked. But we've never actually seen what she was like as a younger girl. So these cadet stories kind of fill in some of the blanks. Also, Handley, nice tie into the Dread film, which will be out early next year and featuring a young Anderson. This is another page of Carlos. This is from Cursed Earth Coburn, written by Gordon, coming up in the magazine later this year. The story is called Going After Billy Zane. Billy Zane, Block City Death Unit, are out in the Cursed Earth on sort of doing a basically a kind of a role play kind of session, and they end up getting caught by the Gila Bruja, if you remember from the old Mission Man story, and Coburn teams up with Rico and goes looking for them. So yeah, that'll be out in the magazine sort of about August, September time. And there's a page of Henry's art from the new series of Zombo. This is in fact Ogmos, the reverse Zombo. Would you like to talk about it?
Ah, yes. Yes, I would. I've always been obsessed with things like the Reverse Flash and Bizarro, the Reverse Flash, those kind of reverse characters. I mean, I did a kind of reverse Judge Dredd recently, if anybody remembers that five-part thing I did last year, I think. And this is, Zombo version 2, because the government have decided that Zombo is frankly underperforming at this point. He's not very good. They've rejigged him. He's twice as tough. He's got a death shadow already built in. He's basically everything that Zombo isn't. He's dedicated. He's on side. He hates crime. He's like a Batman figure. He's like a Dark Avenger of the night. And there he is dealing some justice to a criminal. And while the slightly Donald Trump logo, it's the person I've seen of. That is the president of the government there. He's sort of displaying much as I am here. Displaying Ogmos for the government people. You can expect, obviously the plot of the story is that they get on famously. There's not a single crossword between the two of them. It's a very dull story, really. They have tea. It'll be 10 episodes of polite conversation. I'm not lying. Not at all.
Some of the pages that have been passed that we haven't commented on, there's a page of John Byrne's artwork that came up a bit while ago. That's from a forthcoming new story called Angel Zero that Keck W has drawn. I'll hear it again. This is a new 50-part story that'll start in the around the summertime.
It's amazing. I used to love John Burns when I was a little
countdown,
and he's still doing this gorgeous work. He really is an amazing talent. Yeah. A very underrated artist, yeah. I think, internationally.
John's one of the... There's about five artists now that still deliver physical artwork. So he's one of the last ones that still actually... We actually have the artwork in our hands. Brendan was talking about the use of computers in your artwork. I mean, I would say that pretty much all the artists on the panel use computers at some...
That's right, we deliver digital files and do all the production work that used to be done by the company.
I can remember one of the first times I was in the office meeting Andy, and he opened the drawer of artwork, and you know, I mean, I don't know whether it's me being a bit fanciful, but this drawer power thing that everyone talks about. He opened this drawer, and it was Henry Flint's Nemesis the Warlock from about maybe 10 years ago. I don't know if you remember. He just suddenly kind of sort of burst out this just incredible style. And I'm not kidding, I could almost feel the glow, you know, and it felt like a tangible thing, and it must be a shame, well, it must be nice to still get some of his glow, but it must also be a shame to not get those you know, physical items in your hand, I guess.
I mean, Dave, I mean, you work almost exclusively on computers, would you say?
Well, no, but I mean, I think like Brendan was saying, you know, it is a tool that's available to an artist nowadays. It's no substitute for artistic vision, although it will do filters and things automatically. You still have to be able to draw. And I recently kind of did an experiment where I drew a whole bunch of pages, because if you just do an individual drawing, you can't really judge. And I actually think doing it on the computer is slower for me at the moment. Mm. But there are certain things that the computer is really, really useful for. It's great for doing roughs, but I still actually really like finished artwork. I like the way the noise the pen makes, and I like to have a draw for them to be able to flip through and see how far I've got. So yeah, it is a wonderful production tool. It's, for me, it's the only way to colour, probably because of my lack of any, you know, real art training, that I can finally with the computer get colour to look the way I always wanted it to look. And it is a tremendous tool, but there's something still wonderful about what you know, somebody like John Vernes physically does on a piece of board.
I'd like to add a point on the digital thing, is that what interests me is I'm starting to prefer to look at my work on screen than on the page. And I'm starting to think that it's, you know, it is starting to migrate slowly on the digital as comic sales go down. A bit more and more people are using apps to read comics online. And I mean, I'm really interested in doing a strip that's completely digital, you know, that exists digitally, and you know, and you know, maybe do a hard copy later, you know. But that's something that interests me. Just a straw poll: how many people would read an original strip online on a sort of 2000 AD web page? Most people. Okay, interesting.
But would all of you at some point like to have a physical copy? Because there is a lot of the way. Yeah. So, I mean, to me, almost seems what's the kind of hybrid. It's just like, let's say, American comics. There's a monthly copy, and then people buy the trade. I can almost see the monthly or the weekly comic coming in online, and then people wanting to physically own the collection. Yeah. You know, I think everybody's always going to want the book. If you've got a favourite thing, you want to be able to, just like I said about the artwork, riffle through it, hold it, put it on the shelf, admire it, you know, like we're all up in the same plot there, I know. Yeah, but it's a really exciting. What's really exciting with digital is the delivery is so cheap. The amount of money that's left for the creators is so much more, because you don't have warehouses, distributors, you know. So that's a very attractive
thing. Although Mark Miller did a really interesting analysis of all that, he's quite recently, and he actually came out with less money.
Well, that's the way it is at the moment, but I think, you know, that won't want to get too technical, but after all, 2000 AD is about the future, but I think that there's going to be the equivalent of something like the app store, where you can put your material on there and you can keep 70% of the revenue it generates. And it's just the potential of the huge audience, you know, like something like The Walking Dead has gone kind of huge. If that had only been online, it would be millions of them everywhere.
Yeah, but you need somebody of your clout or people of your level to do something big and digital and make that statement.
Well, it's funny. You know,
yeah, Dave.
No. I mean, I think that's the wonderful thing about the internet, is that if it catches on, if you tweet to people, your years of doing it or your skill really isn't germane anymore, you know. To me, it sounds very democratising and liberating.
I'd like to experiment with returning the lettering to the physical artwork rather than being inside the computer, because although I understand from a letterer's point of view he's getting paid peanuts, it's a much more practical way to go about the job. But I miss the days of the hand-designed sound effects words and the hand-designed logos rather than everything coming from a font package.
Well, I do my own sound effects still, which... which annoys publishers, because they want to be able to translate it into different colours. You know, so, but in the end, fuck. In Italian as it is.
I mean, I do all my lecturing on the computer in my own font, so basically I just cut and paste from the script or whatever. But in days when I used to do physical artwork, because I always lettered my own stuff anyway, it was really nice to do the lettering because you pencil everything out, then you draw the balloons in.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. Then you draw the balloons in, and it was like a little lull in between the two heavy drawing bits, and you get a chance to look at all your artwork, see what you were doing, get some ideas of, and also what you do when you drew the balloons and did the lettering, you kind of killed the blankness of the page.
Yeah.
You gave yourself a foundation and a weight. So.
But also, don't you think, Dave, the design of sound effects, rather than just dropping them on the letter, is just putting on those off-the-shelf sound effects, that designing your own sound effects is really important. Yeah. Eisner used to do it.
Because they are part of the drawing, really, rather than part of the text. Yeah, I agree.
I've got to say, though, like anything, it depends on the letter. I've worked with amazing digital letterers at DC. Clem Robbins on the Losers is amazing. And Jared Fletcher, who's a young guy, but he's really good. And Clem has gone to huge lengths to try and make it look organic. Like he's got kind of like 10 different A's, you know, that he's done by hand and scanned them in. So and he's written a program that kind of, this is really dull, isn't it? he's written a program that will randomly, you know, select various subtly different things and put them. It's, you know, slightly different, so it's not perfect. You know, so it has that organic feel. And I just feel like like anything, actually, it depends what. What the guy doing it or girl doing it, you know, is prepared to put into it. And like you say, computers are an amazingly powerful tool, just like a pen, you know, or a bit of paper, you know.
Well, I think we've got about just under a quarter of an hour left, so I'll open it out to the audience if they've got any questions for the panel.
Does that might work?
I should
just shout it out.
Dave,
you've had a really good experience with the Watchmen film. So what advice have you got? It looks like the Dread film looks okay so far. What advice have you got for us approaching the Dread film?
What advice have we got for you as an audience?
For the creators as well, you know, how should we approach it?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think there's a lot of luck involved. I mean, I can't take credit for whatever's good or bad about the Watchmen movie because, fortunately, it was out of my hands. I mean, I was very supportive of it because the people doing it were 100% behind it. And I don't know much about the Dread movie, but I have read the screenplay, and I don't know if other people here have, and it's a fantastic screenplay. It's so Dread. It absolutely, you can see it drawn by Mick or Brian or Brendan. It feels like a Dread story. And it seems to me that everybody involved with it is very enthusiastic and has got this desire to do it right. And that, to me, I think is where a comic-based movie, you know, succeeds or fails. It has to be true to the spirit of the source material, and the closer it is to that, the more successful it's likely to be. And also the people doing it have to take it seriously rather than think, oh, it's just a comic movie, it's kind of a bit dopey. So I've got very high hopes for this Dread movie, and I know certain people here have been involved with the production to some degree, which again fills me with confidence they're going to the right people. So, but I haven't got any great words of advice. But to anybody who's going to be involved with it, because they've drawn it or something like that, just enjoy it and make the best of the hospitality and the flights and all the freebies.
Shall I talk about the Dread movie a little bit?
Nah.
I saw some of it yesterday. I went to the edit room and they showed me the first 5 minutes and a couple of other scenes. And hopefully you all know that I'm a massive Dread fan. And I was very excited to be working on it. But it looks fucking great. the Lawmaster was the thing that impressed me the most. It looks great. You know, that spy pic, I don't know whether people saw this, but you know, there's like someone snapped a shot of a fat stunt guy on a light from the side. When it's shot properly, when it's shot, you know, a low angle, and I can't say too much, but it looks great. Winding through vehicles along a freeway. It's tough. It's hard. It's violent. It's closest to probably Carlos's first story, The Bank Raid, that was you know, deemed too violent. It has that ethos behind it. Leather, you know, grim, you know. It's drugs as well, actually. It's great. It's just great. I was worried that I'd have to come here and go, yeah, it's all right. Yeah. I'm really happy to say that from what I saw, I saw very raw footage. There was no effects, no, you know, and it's not graded. excuse me, it wasn't properly edited or anything, but I was thoroughly encouraged.
And do you know when this will be released?
It's not finalised yet. There's a couple of options, but it's not finalised. Lionsgate, now they're releasing it in America, and they're sort of calling the shots on that kind of thing, so there's nothing finalised.
It'll be at least a year, So we'd be looking at sort of spring of next year.
The next Kapow.
What sort of things are you doing for the film? Are you going to tie in graphic novel?
People at Bath maybe that couldn't hear is asking what I did for the film and whether there'd be a graphic novel. Well, originally, and Alex Garland that wrote the script is a big Dredd fan. He gets Dredd like a lot on the nose. He was amazing to work with. He had a very specific idea about how to handle it, which you have to do with a film, you know, that, you know, because you know Dredd could be anything. They're interested in getting the script drawn like a comic. So they contacted me, and I did a sort of, it's a kind of like a cross between storyboards and a comic. It was a storyboard level of drawing, it was quite loose, but it was laid out like a comic, so that they could show people what it might look like. When I was working on that, you know, because the style was so loose, I was finding that I just come off doing some concept painting on another film, Dune, an adaptation that's not happening anymore. But I had just finished doing 6 weeks sort of fully painted concept art. So, and it's Dredd, you know. So I just found myself doing pieces just almost for my own, you know, to scratch the itch kind of thing. But also because I was kind of visualizing this script, and if you do a loose, you know, image of a city block, I kind of wanted to show them what I thought a city block might look like, or what the uniform might look like, or, you know, and so I started doing the more painted stuff, which took hold really, and I ended up in the early stages being the only concept artist on it really. What you'll see, there's not much of it that's mine actually, from what you'll see of the uniform, what have you. The gun is probably the closest. That's through direction, that's all mine. Like the first one I did, it had like the red LED, and it was more like the comic one. But they were keen to go in a slightly different direction with it. But as to whether it be a graphic novel, I don't know. I think they're going to release the script visuals as some kind of marketing element at some point, you know. But whether that'll be, I'd be a bit nervous if it was a book, because they're very loose.
When you were doing the concept art, did you have to detach yourself from doing it as if you were doing it for a comic and you do it for a movie?
Again at the back, he's asking if when you do concept art, you have to detach yourself from thinking of it as a comic. I don't want to monopolise the mic here. Concept art's completely different. I've done more and more of it over the last few years, and I really like doing it, and it's a completely different pace.
I was thinking about it with your experience on Dredd,
I did have to do it in a different way, because there are very specific. There's a very specific remit of what they wanted, you know. They're absolutely up for my ideas, but I mean, again, Alex had a very coherent worldview of what the Meg City One and the film was going to be. So I approached it being aware of those parameters, if that makes sense.
If the money allowed, do you both think there'd be a case for publication for a younger readership than there currently is in 2008, so to get younger readers involved in the characters and worlds that have been created in the past?
From an economic point of view, it would cost too much.
That would be an idea if the money allowed.
I mean, it is a potentially possible idea that in terms of there is no bridging title between kids coming up reading the Dino and then going on to something like 2000 AD. You've got something like Toxic, which is possibly more of a magazine than a comic. I think there is a market there that other publishers have tried before to get sort of 10 to 13 year olds reading comics. And it's hard work, I think. I think the environment today is difficult for a new comic to make its mark.
I think actually once they did try and do it kind of junior version in 2008, I did a cover for it. It was called something like
War of the Future.
Yeah, and that was like Orbit 7 or Earth. Yeah, and I remember doing a cover for that, but they obviously tested that out and it didn't quite work. It's interesting, I mean, comics traditionally are aimed at kind of 10-year-olds, whereas now you're saying it's a difficult market to crack. That's quite an interesting comment on the way things have changed.
Well, I mean, certainly releasing something that isn't licensed to something else. I mean, you know, you get a comic based on Ben 10 or Transformers, then you've got a market already there for you. But releasing,
I'm not sure the new Dread movie will be by the way, it's pretty violent.
But 2008 is quite a rare case in the fact it's completely standalone, completely independent. It's not tied to some marketing exercise. So I think at the moment, I think it would cost just too much to launch a new comic aimed at kids.
At the age of seven, and I think one of the things that crept into me as a young kid was the subversive side, because it was through Thatcher's Britain and there was a lot of political conflict going on there. But you said we've all grown up with 2008, you know, if you look at the audience, yeah, we're all in our 40s, most of them.
Yeah.
Do you think 2008 is still doing that? Has it still got the edge that it had back then?
Well, I don't know. I mean, you know, looking back at those days, as you say, with Thatcher's Britain and a much more kind of likelihood of...
We're in Thatcher's Britain.
Well, yeah, you know, but those were the grisly birth pangs of it. Okay, yeah. But also, you know, the kind of threat of imminent nuclear destruction was a much more pressing thing. And it was funny, I rewatched a movie called Threads. It was on the TV. It was absolutely chilling, but that was what it felt like at the time. At any minute, it could just go. And so I think the times we're in now seem kind of different and more bland and committee-ized and everything. I think you know, more coalition. I think it still does feel a little bit subversive, although I think probably it wouldn't be subversive enough for me if I was 20 now, you know? Yeah, but it is an incredible success story that people have stuck with it all this time, because just like I was saying, the traditional age for comics was 10 years old. The fact that probably some people in this room have read it from the age of 10 to the age of 40, it's just fantastic, you know, it's unprecedented.
I think it's not a very good phrase, but capturing the zeitgeist, I think, is what 2008 did in the late 70s and early 80s. There is something about the times and 2000's image and the artwork that's being published, it captured lightning in a bottle. It really tapped into something. I think that paved the way to what took success.
Again, I'm sorry to grab the mic again, but because, you know, I was sort of with the people on this panel, I was sort of there at the beginning. It as you say, it was like capturing lightning in a bottle. We were all there. We were all the people who had grown up, the first wave of people who had grown up reading American comics imported into England. And we were looking for somewhere to be published. And we'd all been doing bits for Odd Comics here and there. But then this came along and it exactly encapsulated what everybody wanted to do. We all knew each other socially. And that's one of the great things about comics now, that most of the people who work on the prog know each other and enjoy each other's company. And it's still got, I think, that kind of family feeling and lads having a lark and ladies having a lark. Yeah.
You want to add to that?
Yeah, I think people are starting to get angry again. I know I am. And I think you will find that increasingly coming through. I mean, there is obviously, you know, these things take time. I mean, more and more I'm starting to put in like savage little digs at the current status quo, and I'm sure I'm not alone in that. There'll be a few of those. And one of the advantages of doing a humor strip and doing Dread is that I can kind of, as things happen that make me incredibly pissed off in the news, I can sort of talk about them through that. So there's a couple of upcoming things, and I don't think it's as savage. I don't think I'm as savage as somebody like Pat Mills. I'm just not as good a writer as Pat Mills. So, nobody's contradicting me. I think people are getting more and more, and I think you'll find increasingly that comes back to a certain extent. I think the New Labour years were kind of a lot of the anger came off the ball, and we were sort of we sort of accepted the most horrible things happening, and you know, without really saying much. And I think now the kind of that spirit of protest is sort of it's definitely coming back, and I think you'll probably see that reflected in increasingly in 2008. Whether we'll hit the heights, I don't know, but I think you will see more of it. Anybody else? Okay.
We better wrap it up. Oh, one more question.
Yeah, I just wanted to say something for Brendan. I love the work you did on the Judder in Judge Dredd and Oz, but I've always loved the way that you draw the helmet differently for Judge Dredd.
Right.
Why?
Well, one of the things, you know, you've got to do, I think, as an artist, I mean, I think I'm in the entertainment industry. This is what this is. And, you know, the sort of Bolland McMahon Dredd was so definitive, I thought I have to make an art by just doing a Dredd slightly differently. So I was looking at a lot of Frank Miller's Dark Knight stuff, and so I basically went. So my thing was to start designing the captions in an eagle shape. I was designing sort of elements in the strip just to give it, oh, that's a Brendan McCarthy Judge Dredd. And I was looking at samurai helmets and just flared his helmet slightly bigger. So, I mean, it was quite calculated to actually create a Dredd that would be slightly to the
left.
It's
always been distinctive.
Yeah, and it was to try and, you know, create an identity for my work. I mean, I had a lot of fun designing all the ancillary stuff to Dredd, really. You know, the Brit set characters hadn't really come into their own, and that was really great fun, designing all the lions instead of eagles, and Japanese Hondo judges. The Australian judges are great. You know, sort of all sitting around drinking beer with shorts on. the origination of all the Judder and the surfing strip was I'd been in Australia and came back and met John Wagner and said, why don't you say about surfing and Australian judges and, you know, Mega Sydney and all that stuff. And so he came up with the whole surfing story, you know. That's how that came about.
I was just disappointed he didn't bump into a thinly disguised version of Mad Max. Was that never thought of?
Well, I mean, The Cursed Earth was a sort of Mad Max-inspired thing, and I did eventually, I don't know if you some of you know, I went on to write and design the new Mad Max movie, and I'd spent a lot of time talking to George Miller, the original, because I wrote it with him, and he was very aware of Judge Dredd in the earlier period, and a lot of the designs from on Mad Max 2 specifically were influenced by 2000 AD, the shoulder pads, and in the 80s shoulder pads were huge, like Joan Collins, Judge Dredd, shoulder pads. Now you don't see them.
It's funny, when I was got the job to work on the Book of Eli, the first thing went through my mind was, yes, I can bring the cursed earth to the big screen.
Sorry,
I'm
just going back to what you said,
the
algorithm with one of the iconic Dredd things I've ever seen from you was the forensic female judge with the fishnet stocking. Yeah.
Are you sure you saw it in
2008?
Actually, my whole favourite thing of 2008 is a bit like Doctor Who, you know, all the different people that played Doctor Who. I like all the different people that played Tharg. And I think that would be an interesting thing, because one of my favourite strips is the photo strip with Dave. I think Kev O'Neill's in it, isn't he?
Kev O'Neill's
in
it, and Nick Landau as
well. Yeah,
I saw it. Brilliant.
They
only got me to do it because John
Wagner. Oh, you were Big Ed, weren't you? Not Tharg.
Yeah. John Wagner, too much money. The one thing I've said it before and I say it again, I found out what it's like to be a superhero. When you're on top of a tall building and the wind is blowing, cape equals sail. I'm not standing close to the edge, should you ever find yourself in a crime fighting situation.
I tried to write digging into my recent Future Shock, but unfortunately the rights to him are owned not by 2000 AD or Rebellion anymore.
Really? Yeah. They're not owned by me.
No. I think they're still with Egmont.
Yeah.
So he would have been in that The Green Pedestrian Palm. I don't know if anyone read that.
Yeah.
But he was in the first draft. Basically, he was going to be, you know, when they all flew in to fight the big giant alien at the end, Biggie was just going to sit back and just write, take notes and draw bits of it.
Would the rights be with DC?
I don't know.
Because DC have got the rights to a lot of the operation.
I probably am now completely owned by DC. But of course, that, you know, that was superheroics back in the days when SFX, you know, or you know, CGI consisted of the art editor with a brush full of white paint painting out my chins. My God, that's why I look so trim. You know, it wasn't months of training.
Given to
Matt and also Steve, any
chance
of Derek
coming
back in front?
Yeah.
Not in the foreseeable, unfortunately. No, okay. No, it remains locked in legal hell. Yeah. And were you featuring Judge Dredd come back on the set of 2008,
the
time of the movie, potentially going to
reinstate that one? Potentially, yeah. Yeah, could do. I hadn't really thought about it, but yeah, it's something we'll consider. I'm sure we'll be. Plugging Dredd for all his work on the movies with. Any other questions? We'll wrap it up. So thanks to all the panel.
There it is, the 2000 AD panel from Kapal. After this came probably the highlight of day one for me. I had been drinking water throughout the panel, and I needed to urinate. And as I was shuffling out of the auditorium, in front of me was Chris Weston and Steve Yowell. And they were saying, you know, I think that went quite well. There wasn't really any lulls. Then one of them said, oh, I hope there's a toilet. And I said, oh, yes, the toilet's this way. And I kind of walked on, they kind of walked with me, and we kind of all had a walk to the toilet together. And then I found myself in an odd position, because I'd previously had an email correspondence with Chris Weston trying to get him along to Cartoon County, possibly for an interview, and then that things kind of went dead, and I thought, I won't bother him, he's probably very busy. Because of course he's writing comics now as well as drawing them brilliantly, but however I found myself at the urinal next to him, whilst Steve Yowell went into the cubicle to I don't know, probably produce a number two. I'd imagine it was beautifully rendered. So I thought it'd be odd if I struck up a conversation now, but it would also be odd if I didn't, and I was a bit torn, but. I decided to say, hello, Chris. I contacted you a while back about possibly doing an interview. He's like, oh, right. Oh, you should email me again. And I was like, okay, yes, that's fine. And I was keen to, let him get on with his urination. But he seemed rather more interested as I backed away, washed my hands and put my hands into the wonderful Dyson Air Slice, which they had there. He said something else, and then I couldn't hear, and I had to go back and say, oh, sorry, what was that? And he said, is there anything you'd like to talk about specifically? And I said, oh, whatever, if you've got anything you want to push at all or promote, that'd be wonderful. It'd just be nice to if you came along and had a chat. And I apologised for, you know, approaching him in the toilet, and made a little joke about maybe sticking my microphone underneath the cubicle to interview Steve Yowell. There was a little chuckle from inside the cubicle there. And to be honest, that really made my day. Just that little encounter. So anyway, I will be emailing Chris Weston at some point, and hopefully at some point in the future we'll have some sort of podcast. But who knows? He's a busy man, and he's not too local, so we shall see.